Radio Tux. The German Ladles Radio. The German Ladles Radio. Start. Hallihallo und herzlich willkommen zur Juli-Ausgabe von Radio Tux. Ja, und heute ein bisschen ohne viel Moderation von mir. Wir haben ja, oder ich habe ja in der letzten Sendung schon angekündigt, dieser Teil wird sich jetzt vornehmlich mit den englischen Interviews von der Cloud Native und KubeCon beschäftigen. Und das erste Interview mit dem Gründer von Hudson und Jenkins. Also Hudson damals noch bei Sun Microsystems, heute Jenkins X, ist sehr spannend, ist aber auch sehr schwer verständlich und ja, also eventuell müsst ihr das einfach mehrfach hören, wenn es euch interessiert und ihr ihn nicht ganz so gut verstanden habt. Außerdem gibt es noch einiges zum Thema Helm. Wir beschäftigen uns damit, wie Kubernetes released wird, wie das mit dem Release-Team funktioniert. Es geht um Foundations, Community Manager und Cloud Native Storage. Und ich wünsche euch jetzt ganz viel Spaß, wie gesagt, beim ersten Interview, zur Not mehrfach hören. Yeah, I'm here on the KubeCon in Barcelona. With me is KK. He's the chief scientist at CloudBees. Hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
So, a long while ago, you founded Jenkins. Maybe we can go a trip down the memory lane and you can explain me how that did this start?
Sure. So, back then I was working as an individual software engineer and, one of the developer of the four engineering team. I mean, the team of four engineers, basically. And then I used to be a guy who breaks builds all the time. So this was back in the day of CVS. Those of you old enough might remember those. And then among many deficiencies, one of them is like, if you commit from the wrong directory, you end up committing subset of what you wanted to commit. So that happened all the time and people give me a phone call saying, hey, like you touched this file and it doesn't compile. So like, do you know what's going on? And then sure enough, like I didn't do it right. So I thought it was embarrassing at one point. And then so I wrote a couple of shell scripts so that my program can catch my mistake before my colleagues do. And it turned out that, I wasn't the only one who's breaking builds all the time. So it kind of quickly spreads through my team and then my colleagues. And then pretty soon the entire, the department was relying on it. And then this was also around the time where some microsystems where I used to work was doing everything in open source. So this software was also open source from the very beginning. And then, it turned out that it wasn't just our team inside Sun Microsystems. It's basically every software developer in the whole world had the same problem. So that's kind of how it started and grew.
And then Sun Microsystems was bought by Oracle, right? And that get complicated then?
Yeah. So I stayed in Oracle for a few months. I thought, hey, this is a free opportunity to try out Oracle. And then if it didn't work out, then I could always leave. And what have I lose to just get a taste of it. So, and Oracle wasn't my cup of tea. And then I left Oracle. Basically back then I was the only person working on the project. And then this was, this had started as my hobby project too. So, I think after I left, maybe half a year after I left Oracle, I think Oracle decided that they wanted to do something with this project after all. And they looked around and they thought this was a Sun Microsystems project and they realized that nobody else is left to do anything about it. So what was unfortunate was I think this happened under a leader who didn't understand open source. So I think he decided that the way to bring back the control is to trademark the name and then basically tell this bunch of open source developers that, if you wanted to keep playing with this software, then you gotta follow our rules. And then, that really royally pissed off all the open source contributors. And it also didn't help that the Oracle back then didn't have a good developer relations. So So that led to essentially fork. Like, we like to call it renaming because pretty much everyone in the community kind of stayed with us to the Jenkins project. And then that's how the project got renamed to Jenkins. And then that was already 2011. So, you know, at this point, it's like a long time ago. But yeah, that was one of the drama.
And what has changed since then?
So what I think the change, maybe, so it was a fairly, traumatic memory for the community. So I think if anything, the sense that it developed was we wanted to make sure that the governance of the project was not controlled by one vendor. So it created a heightened interest to make sure that the project remains neutral and so on. So, you know, that leads to eventually. So that was the 8 years after that, we finally found that new home in the Continuous Delivery Foundation. So hopefully we get to talk about that a little later. Yeah.
And now there are a couple of Jenkins out there. I saw a new thing called Jenkins X. What is the difference between Jenkins and Jenkins X?
Mm-hmm. So Jenkins X is interesting take on. It's almost like a new project. I think that might be easier way to explain it. Right. So, you know, well, this is KubeCon. So, you know, one of the big movement that's happening in our landscape is this, you know, the cloud native movement backed by the Kubernetes and its ecosystem. So it's enabling the whole new kind of software development practice that people are trying to figure out right now, right? There are like 7,000 people right now, right here, trying to figure that out. So, now, what we thought was, well, like, it's kind of doesn't make sense. It does not make sense for every team to invent their own way of how to develop software productively on top of Kubernetes. Like, for most people, these are like an infrastructure detail that they shouldn't care about. So in Jenkins X, what we wanted to do was to bring, you know, the people in the Jenkins community who live and breathe this cloud native ecosystem. And then they are going to, like, pick up the useful tools and services, wire them together in productive ways, then hide them behind a pleasant command line interface. So users of Jenkins X only need to think in high-level concepts of application developers, the application development that they already are familiar with. So, you know, you might not know too much about the Kubernetes API, but everyone kind of have this, let's say, QA environment, dev environment, production environment, and so on. And there are good practices like GitOps. There's promoting binaries from one location to another. So I think that collectively, if you forget for the moment of the details of the Kubernetes, how one should how a team should develop web application. I think that's pretty well understood. So in some sense, what the Jenkins X does is just map those concepts and then translate that into the right API call to the right backend system so that the user shouldn't have to learn and figure that out. So that's the kind of key idea of the Jenkins X. It's, I see it as a expansion of a very creative expansion of the vision and mission of the Jenkins project, which is why it carries the name, which is like, we are all about making software developer more productive, right? And then it's because of there's like a whole new wild west of ecosystem going on. Let's help them in this new land as well.
So as a developer, I don't need to interact with Kubernetes API at all, right?
Yeah. At least to the extent of like in the writing. So all you basically have to do is like, check out the code and your local machine and then do the build. And then Jenkins X can even help you create the PR. And then all the right wiring, like as soon as you file the PR, what you want to happen is like this pull request gets built and tested. And we even deploy that like a code under review as a running application so that people can interact with it if you want. So all these like a wiring of automation that's supposed to happen behind the scene, that gets taken care of. That's a key value prop.
And is Jenkins X a complete rewrite of Jenkins, or are there any code still there?
Yeah, so Jenkins is used behind the scene in some, so like when it runs a build in pipeline, like you can use Jenkins. But the bulk of the Jenkins X is actually written in Go. So in some sense, it's not really a fork or it's not a new version. It's a very different project. It's different. different purpose and requirements and like a context. So yeah.
And how does it interact with Git and GitHub or GitLab? Is it interchangeable?
So I think, so let's see. So for example, so there are some integration with GitHub, for example, where, you know, when you first you create a new project, so you can create, I think the JX create like a Spring app or something, and then you do create like a skeleton Spring app, and then it will create a repository on GitHub, and then it will do all the right wiring. I don't remember off the top of my head if you already support GitLab or not, but you know, those are the same ecosystem play that Jenkins Projects has been doing in the past. So I think it's just a matter of writing a connector.
Yeah. Okay. And if not, somebody will one day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, and you also mentioned earlier before GitOps, mm-hmm. so I can use this methodology with Jenkins X, right?
Right, so the way the Jenkins X uses GitOps is, you know, the kind of key practice of GitOps is to capture the state or the configuration of the running applications in any given environment as a text file in the Git repositories, right? So, and then that's what the Jenkins X does. So, different for every environment. So let's say you have a dev environment, QA and production. So you have three environments and every environment gets its own set of files that captures what version of what microservices are running there. And then, so when the developer type command like JX promote, then that's the developer or the CI system telling Jenkins X that it's time to promote this version of app from, say, this app from dev to QA environment. Then behind the scene, it checks out this state repository and update the line that signals the version number and then create the PR in the state repository. So depending on how you do it, like, you know, if it's a production, you might want actually humans to come in and approve the PR, then that initiates the deployment. Or if it's in the dev environment, maybe you want that automatically get merged after like some validation. And then, so you can configure it that way too. So that's how like a GitOp becomes an integral part of Jenkins X.
And then if I have an app, I can say, okay, that's the development version and now go to the production.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then so in that way, you know, there's an entire track record of which version of the what app was deployed when, and then in a regulated software development environment, that kind of audit trail is an important like artifact, right? And that also this like authorization and access control around who can merge what changes to the repository and exactly what checks happen between is also part of this compliance story for many enterprise. So in that sense, I think the GitOp really blends nicely where the technology, the practice, I think it's an unusual example of something that the technology people approve of, GitOps, is also actually very valuable for the business people, compliance people. So I think it is a great practice.
Yeah. So Jenkins and Jenkins X aren't the only CI pipelines out there. There are also Circle CI, GitLab CI, and so what is the main difference between those?
So Jenkins has always been this like an incredibly flexible, versatile like a CI/CD system that sort of like meet people wherever they are, right? Because I think if you're in the KubeCon, it's easy to forget, but there's actually quite a variety and diversity in the software development ecosystem, ranging from mobile applications to video games to embedded C++ code to COBOL app in mainframe. And people are, like most enterprises, like doing many of those. So it's never just one thing. I think in that sense, this like a flexibility and versatility of Jenkins has been always useful. And then I think it still very much is. In that regard, I think, I don't think there's any competition in that space. Now, Jenkins X is really focused on this cloud native web application development, because that's this combination of, Kubernetes and its ecosystem is enabling this very rapid software development that's previously not really possible unless you're like a Google or Uber or something. So by necessity, I think Jenkins X really needs to focus on that sweet spot. And then I think that also makes what Jenkins X unique. Right? So you mentioned about the Circle CI and so on. So those are general purpose hosted CI/CD solutions. And then, so therefore, I think because of that generality, I think they failed to leverage the really like a Kubernetes specific to this. So, yeah.
But Jenkins X is also hosted by CloudBees, right? I can use the ZAS thing and install it on my own.
Yeah, so the Jenkins X is actually open source project. So it's something you download. And in fact, it's basically a command line tool that you're going to install on your own computer. And then it interacts on the server side components that's going to run inside the Kubernetes. And those are basically assembly of existing software that's developed elsewhere, you know, like in the Kubernetes ecosystem or like a Jenkins itself. So yeah, it's not a service. It is open source project. Yeah.
And do I need to build my own Kubernetes cluster, or how does this work?
So it works with any Kubernetes distributions, so including like a GKE, AWS, and so on. In fact, it'll even have the command that sets up the entire cluster for you. So it really like tries to make the Kubernetes development accessible. And then so I think we have people using it with many different kinds of Kubernetes flavors.
If I like, I can use my own.
Yeah.
So I don't know, not long ago, there is a new foundation under the hood of the Linux Foundation, Cloud Continuous Delivery Foundation, right? And you're on the board.
Yeah, so it's called the Continuous Delivery Foundation. So the idea is, there are different people with different motivation, but for me, the most important part is... As I was working, so you know, I've been doing this Jenkins for a good long while. So I've been talking to lots of practitioners and you know, people in the trenches, people in the enterprise trying to drive this movement forward. And I often discover that they are struggling to rally their organization around their effort, especially in the big ones. So what that means is like they don't have the time or people or money to drive this effort successfully. So I think the part of the problem is this practice, I think it's taken for almost granted among the technology people, but like, you know, I think ultimately this is actually more of, the movement that has impacted the business. And then I don't think like we've explained that well enough. So, if you look at, for example, like in contrast, say the AI or machine learning, like the business people instantly understood the like a fundamental risks that or the opportunity that poses to their business, right? And then that unlocks so much, like, you know, again, the resources, like money, people, and so on to work on this. So I think continuous delivery, in my mind, has the same level of impact. And I think some people see that when you see like Uber disrupting the taxi industry or Airbnb disrupting the hotel industry. Like it's an example of like a technology, the ability to develop software rapidly, making a, you know, life or death difference to the business. So for me, that's the kind of like a message that we need to elevate. But it is difficult for a single open source project or single vendor, like, you know, Jenkins or CloudBees, to talk authentically about these things. I think it takes multiple vendors, like a saying, to say those messages and, you know, Continuous Delivery Foundation being a place where lots of different companies come together, I think they can do that. So, you know, we mentioned a bit about the Circle CI. So they are actually a member of the CDF. And, you know, in this last Monday, we did a continuous delivery, the first summit as a touched event, the CNCF. And then there, one of the panel session, we brought all these folks and they are like, I was really happy to see these people basically singing the same tune. I think it's going to create a big impact.
Okay, which CIs has which firms are already in the foundation?
Yeah, so I don't know. I think what I remember is like there are 7 or 8 the premier sponsors, and then there are 20 or so general members. So it comes in 2 tiers. So the major tool vendor in this space are there. And then what I also like is I also saw the end user companies like HSBC, Capital One, they are there. And then I think that's a good testament that some companies and the financial industry is certainly one space where people like they understood the impact that the technology can have on their future. So I think that sense is very well understood there. That I think the rest of the world, rest of the industries, when they see those end users are being there and then they are being successful in making better software faster, then I think it's going to spread a lot more quickly.
And how will you get the message out, how continuous delivery and stuff works? I mean, okay, you told me there was already an event here at the KubeCon before, but will there be more events? How will this evolve?
Right. So I think the marketing activities or events, I think those are obviously a key part of it. So, and then when you look at the CNCF is doing, I think the Linux Foundation understands that part very well. And then they have a proven track record of, white papers, or the case studies, so websites and so on and so forth, because historically, open source projects were not good at these things. We've been, generally, people are in the mindset of, we can just produce code and we're going to put it here. So if you like it, go use it. If you don't, I don't really care about it, has been the prevailing attitude. I think it's kind of a short selling the awesomeness of the code. So I think, the structure and the people and other expertise to be able to amplify the awesome code, I think that's very valuable. So that's certainly one. But at the same time, the code ultimately, this is open source project, group of open source projects. So producing the foundation can be only successful when the good work happens under its watch. So, so I'm sitting in the technical oversight committee as a chair this year. So I'm kind of keen on encouraging those collaboration across the project boundaries. And that's something I think I learned a lot by in the process of building and nurturing the Jenkins community, because it is also became over a period of time a pretty big umbrella where lots of different people are working on lots of different parts. So I learned a thing or two about how to facilitate and how to encourage good collaboration. And when you can build the social structure or the incentive like that, then really amazing things happen. Mm-hmm. So that's also obviously important. So I think those are two tracks, engineering work and good marketing work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And getting consumer feedback, like I said, from the banks and stuff like that.
Yeah. So end users, as we call them, I was just talking to the Salesforce guys in this show, and then they are another end users. They are not in the business of, they are not vendors. And then so they are saying the same message, we need more of these people out there. To be able to clearly articulate the challenges that they're having. And I think that influences the direction of these projects and vendors. So I think that's really awesome when that happens.
Okay. Thank you very much. I hope you have a great success with your new foundation and with Jenkins X as well. And thank you, KK, for having the time to talk to me.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Hi, this is Greg Crow Hartman. I'm a Linux kernel developer, and this is Radio Talks.
here on the KubeCon in Barcelona. With me is Lachlan Evenson. He's program manager at Microsoft on Azure Container Compute. Hi, Lachie.
Hello, how are you doing? It's great to be here.
Now 5 years Kubernetes, or nearly 5 years. What do you think about that?
Well, so it's amazing. My story actually starts at the launch of Kubernetes 5 years ago. So I was on stage when Kubernetes was kind of announced and donated out. I saw the creation of the Cloud Native Compute Foundation and Kubernetes fall under it. I think it's absolutely fantastic to see just how much the community has grown and what a great community we have around Kubernetes. And Kubernetes itself, it's so mature. I'm seeing, you know, a great platform to build workloads on and have them orchestrated by a great platform like Kubernetes.
Why do you think it's such a success?
Undoubtedly the community. You know, there was a need. So I got into Kubernetes because I was looking to build containerized workloads for a company I worked for, and Kubernetes was an orchestrator that was there when I needed it. But, you know, but the community, you know, in those days, there wasn't any documentation. There wasn't too many things around. So entering the Kubernetes ecosystem was challenging. So understanding what was there. But thankfully, even in those days, there was a community and I could reach out to people. And even that stands true today. So meeting new people, and this is their first KubeCon at the booth, and the questions they have, I'm really excited to be able to help them and give back for the people that actually gave to me. But I think community is the number one reason why Kubernetes has seen so much success.
And other reasons? I mean, at the beginning, there were a lot of orchestrators, Mesos, more. But yeah, Kubernetes was the one now everybody is talking about, and the others are not gone, but close.
Yeah, so for me, it really goes back to community. So when I was looking for this, I had this problem that I wanted Container Orchestrator to solve. And when I was looking around at the different container orchestrators out there, I was really able to get answers around Kubernetes really quickly and get up and running and solving problems, which was what I needed. So that really helped shape my perception of Kubernetes, having this community of people that can actually help me. So that was why, you know, I had a wonderful first experience with Kubernetes, and I hope to pay that back to the community now by, as newcomers are coming in, helping them have a wonderful experience.
And do you think also the CNCF as an organization had a big part on the success?
Yeah, absolutely. In the early days when we were looking at Kubernetes, it was, who's looking after the code? Where is it? This is open source, but who owns it? So I think, you know, it was quite a great move by the folks at Google at the time to create the CNCF in partnership with the Linux Foundation and create a good home going forward for Kubernetes at the start. So when I was using Kubernetes, a lot of the doubt of who owns this, where is it, is there a foundation backing it? A lot of those questions were answered having the CNCF around. And now obviously, you know, the CNCF is growing, the ecosystem's growing, having great marketing and a great way to push messages out and make that consistent and get that knowledge to the community members, whether it's documentation, blogs, you know, they do great things for the community at large.
And events like this one?
Oh, events like this are awesome. I've seen this go from, I remember the Plaza Hotel in San Francisco, it was several hundred in September 2015. And now, you know, we have close to 10,000 people here in Barcelona, in a wonderful city, in a wonderful venue. It's great to see how far it's come and how many people are here.
Yeah, on the conference and as well on the keynotes, inclusion and diversity is also a big thing. Do you think this is also a part of the big success?
Absolutely. We want to create an open community that includes everybody, no matter where they come from and what they know. So I think taking that and putting meaning behind it and practices behind it to support it is something that the CNCF has done a wonderful job making sure that we create diverse and inclusive communities.
What do you think about the language Kubernetes is written on? Is this also a part which attract more people than, let's say, it would be written in C++ or so?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was looking at Kubernetes back in 2015, Go was relatively new to me for the software that I was writing at that time. So I had to learn it, but it was a really easy on-ramp to learn Go. So I think that probably facilitated a lot of the attention. And it certainly lowered the bar in terms of how hard it was to contribute. So even though there are a lot of lines of code, Kubernetes is still fairly elegantly simple to read once you know where to look. But I think, you know, Golang helped facilitate it, contributors early. As opposed to some other languages, like you mentioned, C++. But even though in saying that, there are vibrant communities like the Envoy community in CNCF as well, which is Envoy is written in C++, that are equally as vibrant. Even still, they have C++ as their language. So I don't know if language is as much of an inhibitor as people think it is, but I certainly think in the early days of Kubernetes, Golang really helped allow people to get on board and get their hands and feet wet.
It could also be written in Java, I think.
Yeah, totally. I think the interesting thing with Golang back in the day was it was really cloud focused. So they put a lot of time into integrating with kind of cloud primitives in the libraries. So you had the handles that you needed to actually provision infrastructure on the cloud and do things, to the level that Kubernetes needed them. So I think that certainly helped guide what Kubernetes is today.
What's about release early, release often? Is this also a part of the success?
Yeah, so the release cadence is still, it's 4 releases a year, right? So every 3 months we release a new software. So I actually represent on the current release team, and we're working on 1.15. I think in the early days, you know, back I came on board to Kubernetes around 0.8. But to have that cadence of releasing features and stabilizing every 3 months and taking that feedback from the communities and the users of Kubernetes has really helped shape getting things fixed, adding new features, and then stabilizing it so that we have things, you know, like custom resource definitions these days, which has really helped scale and make Kubernetes more extendable. So I think the release cadence, while it seems pretty quick, helps the project progress and solve problems really quickly.
So what's your part in the Kubernetes project you said right now?
I'm on the release team. So one of the areas I serve in is on the release team. So for every release, there is a team of members who get nominated to serve. There are many roles. I am a release lead shadow. So the release lead is the one that's responsible for making sure that all the pieces come together over the lifetime of the release, make sure that the features are checked in, that the tests are passing, that the releases get cut on a specific date and time. So we're almost 3/4 of the way through the 1.15 release now. So it's great to see, even with events like this, that the project still keeps going.
And how is it decided which parts got in the release and which will be later releases?
Right. So the process that has been introduced in 1.14, it was made mandatory, is the Kubernetes Enhancement Proposal, KEP process. So this is a way to declare your intent to add an enhancement to Kubernetes. So that's a document that gets checked into GitHub. It has motivation, summary, implementation details, test plans, graduation criteria. So there is a role on the event team called the enhancements lead, and they have a team of shadows as well. So in each release, we ask if there is a KEP, an enhancement proposal, we ask, would you like it in this release? And the people that own... The people that own that proposal and the SIGs that sponsor that proposal, they take the effort and in saying, yes, it's going to go into this release, and we have to ensure that the proposal is in the right state and that the people who are going to write the code and the documentation are willing to participate in this release. And then we track it. And over the course of the release, we make sure there are milestones so that we have deliverables and the code shows up. And at the end of it all, that, you know, there are many, people that use KEPs, but KEPs are also a means to share in the release notes of each release, highlighted features that are going from alpha to beta to stable, or brand new net new features in, or stability features as well. So we take all the ones that have been committed and we build release notes and blog on the features so that the community knows and the users of Kubernetes know the new features and the stability improvements of that release.
So what will be the new features in .15?
So there's, at last glance, there are 46 new features going in. One I looked at yesterday, so I'm only going to speak of one off the top of my head, and that was about volume resizing using CSI. So that's the where you can change the size of a storage volume via CSI. And CSI is a relatively new interface in Kubernetes, introduced in, well, it went GA in 1.13. So specifically, if you were to go and look in the 1.15 in enhancements, you would see CSI volume resize enhancement in there. So that's one that's coming. Another one that I'm specifically working on, and that we're working on over at Azure with our upstream team, is dual stack. So this is having IPv4 v6 workloads in Kubernetes, which has been something that you know, large service providers have been asking for. And also, as the IoT and edge discussion heats up, and Kubernetes is a platform that people are looking to solve IoT and IoT edge to distribute those workloads, we need to have the addressing available for them. So IPv4 and v6, and multiple interfaces per pod as well, so that we can lay down NFV style workloads onto Kubernetes. So that's going to be that project, and dual stack is going to be multi-release, but we're excited to be working on that with the community and bringing that out as well. So the first stage is scheduled to go live in 1.15.
When will 1.15 be ready?
So 1.15, I don't know on the exact date. I believe it's at the end of June, but I would have to double check. Because we have a little shorter of a timeline because of this KubeCon in Shanghai as well. So they've modified the dates, but I believe the end of June.
But these conferences are also nice that developers come together and maybe quick fix something.
Oh, absolutely. The face-to-face is invaluable. You know, these people in the community have built relationships via Slack and via Zoom and in these meetings, but the face-to-face time to build those relationships can often speed up a lot of project progress in the community, where you can have open discussions and make quick decisions to move the project forward. So venues like KubeCon are invaluable, so that all the people around the world that contribute to Kubernetes have a chance to chat face-to-face.
How do you think will Kubernetes evolve the next 5 years?
I think the same 5 years, I don't know if I can speculate that far out, but it's okay. I would say, you know, that the patterns that I'm seeing emerging is extensibility, so making it easy to plug things into Kubernetes. Abstractions, so building abstractions on top of Kubernetes, like the SMI that we announced the other day, the service mesh interface. And stability. So there'll be core features that will become stabilized in Kubernetes, specifically, and we'll want to scale Kubernetes clusters larger. So stability, scalability, extensibility, I'd say would be the major themes. And then for workloads on top of Kubernetes, I think the themes will be higher level abstractions like service mesh interface and things like that.
How was the conference from your perspective?
Fantastic. I do a lot of time on the booth, which is my voice sounds a little hoarse. I really enjoy being on the booth, but I must say I was very surprised at the level of questions and technical expertise within the community. No longer are we talking about how to install Kubernetes. I remember the days where that was the most important question to answer, certainly. Now we're talking about how do we solve higher level problems and what other tooling we might be able to build as the community, and what other great experiences we can give folks with people who are coming to Kubernetes now and make that easier for them. So again, very impressed with the questioning. And I love problem solving. So I love being on the booth and hearing what problems people are trying to solve and seeing if I can help.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Helm. Can you tell me what's Helm?
Yeah, Helm is the Kubernetes package manager. So I had the privilege of working on Helm back when it was at Deis. Now the core maintainers of the Helm project are at Microsoft. They're colleagues of mine. But Helm is about taking these resources and that are Kubernetes manifests and packaging them up to define your application and installing, upgrading, downgrading. So having that kind of package management experience, you can think of it like maybe apt-get install for Kubernetes would be a good paradigm. But we wanted to make it easy to have these applications bundled up and installable so they could be reused and that folks could actually iterate on their applications using charts. And charts is the deployable unit for Helm. And not only could you build them, you could share them. So chart repositories are another big piece of Helm. So I can build a chart and you can download it and install it. You know, a service provider, somebody providing a HashiCorp console, HashiCorp could give you console, and via Helm you could install console on your Kubernetes cluster. So it gives you that great experience to deploy applications on top of Kubernetes and workloads.
These Helm charts are YAML files or what?
So Helm charts are the application package format. They contain templated Kubernetes resources. And basically, Helm knows how to interpret those templates and provide values into those templates so that you end up with resources on Kubernetes with those templated values filled in.
And can I write my own Helm chart? So are there skeletons?
So we have an upstream charts repo. So if you go to GitHub/Helm/charts, there are all the community charts in GitHub format. You can also go to hub.helm.com. That's Helm Hub, where you can go and just search for different applications. Let's say you want to install Jenkins. You can type in Jenkins and install it on your cluster via Helm Hub. So we've created a great ecosystem of applications in Helm, but Helm has been around for a long time. And one of the things that we announced the other day was the alpha of Helm 3. So this is a fantastic milestone in the Helm community and for the Kubernetes community at large. So a lot of the, because Helm was written so long ago, Kubernetes has moved so fast. Helm 3 is an opportunity to take advantage of all the new features of Kubernetes and have a more native experience in Helm. So one of the big announcements was we're removing the server-side component of Helm, Tiller, which was a point that a sticking point for security-wise for people that wanted to have tight security control on their clusters. So we're removing that component in Helm 3 so that people can use Kubernetes native security and RBAC to implement their Helm charts. So we're very excited to announce Helm 3, and we suggest that people go and take a look at it and provide feedback.
Yeah, when it was announced on the keynote, everybody cheered.
Yeah, I saw a lot of feedback. Everybody cheered Helm 3, the removal of Tiller. It's got a lot of excitement and a lot of momentum in the community. A lot of people use Helm. This was the answer to the culmination of working with the community for many months, listening to them and implementing their feedback in what we thought would be, as a community, the Helm community, the best experience we could provide for Kubernetes as it stands today and installing applications. So I was really flattered to see that feedback, that everybody cheered and everybody was very excited. The Helm team themselves, some of the maintainers are colleagues and friends of mine, and I'm sure it's really warming to the hearts because I know they put a lot of effort into helping make this a great experience for the community.
Do you know when Helm 3 will be ready?
I think currently we're shooting towards, so there's a Helm summit in the EU in September in Amsterdam. So we released the alpha. I think the milestones are going to be, we'll work up towards a release candidate or closer to GA. So I would keep an eye on out for around September timeframe at Helm Summit in Amsterdam. And I would invite everybody to join that. If you're in this area and you want to learn more about Helm, come along. We had the first one last year in Portland, and people are still commenting to me today on the booth that what a great event that was and how much they learned about Helm So yeah, if you're in the area, come along to Amsterdam. It's going to be a good time in September.
Okay, maybe we will see each other there.
Yes.
So if I have my own Helm chart ready, what do I do with it? So can I upload it to the hub?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of ways you can get it onto the hub. The hub is about you create different Helm repositories and you link them to the hub. So the hub will help redirect that traffic to your individual Helm chart repository. So you can create your own repositories and link them in hub and have your charts there so people can search and install them. A number of companies are doing that today. Or you can go to the upstream Helm chart repository and check them in there. There's a stable path and an incubator path where you might be trying to prove out your application and get feedback. You can go and submit your chart there and have it reviewed by the maintainers upstream.
So if I want to have my own repo, how do I do that?
So to build, there's tooling inside Helm to build a chart repo, but a chart repo is essentially a web server that has an index file, which has the location and details and SHA around each chart. And each chart can be thought of at that point as a zipped up tarball. And basically you pull it via the web server down and it gets unpacked and then the contents of that are installed. So that's how you can share and distribute charts. It's a fairly lightweight process to do that.
So just need a web server.
Just need a web server, exactly. And I see a lot of people doing it with GitHub pages. So they have their charts checked in, they just GitHub page, turn it on. And then in the tool, you can say Helm repo add, put the URL, Helm repo search. And if you created your own chart, I could go ahead and install that.
But I heard if there are many charts in a repo, that doesn't scale very well. So that there's something new in the 3 version.
Yeah, so we've been looking a lot at repositories and how we can store and scale repositories a lot. Because as you mentioned, scaling and having, the index.yaml is growing and growing and growing and it doesn't scale and how do you search it? So yeah, I'd encourage people to go and have a look at what we've done in repositories in Helm 3, because there's a lot of new features and we're still kind of working it out. So even though it's alpha, we would encourage your feedback to come and look at how we're trying to solve repositories. But some of the ways is, hey, we have a Helm repository. Can we actually store the charts in a Helm repository inside a container repository? So we don't have to have a Helm chart repository and a container repository, because we all know we have a container repository. So, a lot of work's being done to see, can we actually store this in a container repository so I can pull both Helm charts? And this is not a new concept, but trying to get that work upstream so that all the chart repositories support it, I think it's a good step forward for the users and the community out there at large.
So I can use then my harbor or something like that to store Helm charts?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can use the same thing that you're storing your containers in. And what that serves is you only have a single point that you need to back up and make sure is actually running rather than having your Helm charts in a different place and needing that kind of care and love as well. So yeah, very excited about the breakthroughs in repositories as well.
Any other news about Helm 3?
Yeah, so there's a lot of good news. So removal of till is a big thing. Namespace releases is another big thing. So releases used to be globally for each cluster. You can only have one name release. If I wanted to install Jenkins and you wanted to install Jenkins, we could only have one release called Jenkins on a whole cluster, but now it's namespaced. So you could have a release called Jenkins in your namespace and I can. So that's a big game changer. Libraries, so chart libraries. So when you take a look at charts in Helm 2, they are templated versions and it's all string-based, right? So templates, think of a Kubernetes deployment where we've templated the values that are interpolated. In Helm 3, we're able to build a library where you could say, well, this is what a deployment looks like for my specific company or for this chart. And then you can say, in this, I just want to put the one value. So it stops a lot of copying, pasting. You can basically import from a library, a deployment, and then just change its container image, for example. So it stops a lot of copying, pasting. The other thing that serves is the input variables or the values.yaml, we can do some typing on them. So are they integers? Are they strings? What this allows us to do, so in Helm 2, if you put a string in where it should be an integer, or you put an integer in where it should be a string, Kubernetes, it's a very late binding error. Kubernetes throws an error. So you have a release that's pushed out and Kubernetes throws an error. Now we can actually say, well, if this is supposed to be an integer and you put a string in, I will throw an error before it gets to Kubernetes. So that typing allows for early validation, which stops broken releases. So there's a lot of great usability things in Helm 3 to make charts easy to write. But I will say that you can use the charts that are already there in Helm 2. So bringing the charts across so you don't have to write new charts, or you can write new charts and use the new tooling. So it's equally as important to bring that Helm 2 ecosystem, which is the production grade software that we have now, as Helm 3 is still in alpha. Once we get that up to the same level, you know, writing native Helm 3 charts is also an option.
So if I start now with Helm, should I write Helm 3 charts then?
I think if you're in production today, you're still running Helm 2. You're still running Helm 2. But Helm 3, it would be interesting to look at and start kick the tires. So take a look, tell us what works. We really want to take the time to get an alpha and the importance of an alpha so people can get a feel for it. Is this what you want? How can we change it? How can we make a better experience? That's the phase that project is in. So I would invite people to take a look.
And where should I go and say, oh, here's the bug or that feature is missing?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's Helm channels in Slack. There's a Helm community meeting as well. So if you go to github.com/helm/helm, you can take a look at where the community meetings are. Feel free to come in, put an agenda item on if you haven't something you want to discuss. And for short break fixes, go ahead and raise an issue and provide the appropriate detail. The maintainers and the team that work on it will take a look at it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lucky, for being here and telling us about Kubernetes 5 years and how Helm works and Helm 3. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was wonderful chatting to you.
Dream about when we were young and the world was our playground to claim. Everything seemed like a new gift just waiting for us to share. Do you still dream that we're falling in love for the first time again and again? Walking on clouds with the sun in our pockets without a care.
So I'm on the KubeCon in Barcelona. With me is Brandon Young. He's responsible for partnerships and alliances with GitLab. And my first question is, what is GitLab?
So GitLab, in a simple sense, is a single tool for the entire DevOps lifecycle. What does that mean, though? Functionally, you can bring an IDE, integrates directly with GitLab, and then GitLab can take you all the way through the security, the deployment, the testing, and everything, and deploy directly, in this case, on a Kubernetes. So we're that intermediate tool that makes your world much easier and more secure.
And then I have my website or my app running.
And then you're do it, and then you're...
And then I have my app website running on Kubernetes. Correct.
I mean, still have to operate. We don't manage your Kubernetes cluster, so you're still responsible for all that fun, which is most of what the crowd here is focused on is getting the Kubernetes clusters up and monitoring them and everything. But end of the day, a Kubernetes cluster with no applications in it is still just a blank Kubernetes cluster. It doesn't do a lot of good. So you got to put the apps in it.
Is the difference to GitHub? I mean, more people maybe know GitHub because of there are so many open source projects using GitHub. What's GitLab then?
Sure. Both are based off of Git as a foundational piece. So from source code management, GitHub and GitLab both use Git as a base for source code management. Big difference is GitLab is open source. GitHub is closed source. The other big difference is GitLab is not just source code, so it's upstream planning. So this would be how you build your epics, how you do your planning for building the software, which is upstream from your source code and when you write it. Then it also has the best CI platform. Again, this according to Forrester. I'm saying this not because I said it. I actually have a quote for why. But it has full CI platform. That has embedded security in it. So helping that shift left has always been useful from development. This is, we're helping shift left the security process as well. And then full CD into Kubernetes. So monitoring embedded in there as well.
But if I have still my own CI/CD pipeline, I can still use GitLab, right?
Sure. Yeah. So works with Travis, with Jenkins, with Circle. We're the most common backend source code management for them as well, because most of them operate on-prem, and that's where GitLab, we're about 2/3 of the private Git repositories and self-managed ones. So majority of those tools also rely on GitLab as their source code.
And they integrate well?
Yep, integrates just fine. Yeah, ton of customers doing it. So, yeah.
And what's the difference between GitLab CI and Jenkins, for instance?
Well, Jenkins has two options. So they have Jenkins, traditional Jenkins, and Jenkins X, focused on different markets. Jenkins X focused and requires a Kubernetes cluster, for example, to run. GitLab single tool either way. So you can run that just on VMs if you want. You can run it bare metal, or you can run it on a Kubernetes cluster. And so some of the advantages, most customers don't live fully in one world or another. They have applications that they run, they have that exist today, and they run on-prem, on VMware, on bare metal, on you name it. And then they also have Kubernetes clusters they want to run on, and they need applications of both places. And so the strength of GitLab is that it solves to both, and it can be a single tool for visibility. Same team can be developing at one point and deploying on-prem into, you know, VMware, and then same exact tool can be deploying, and it's just a different deployment into a Kubernetes cluster. So that versatility is something that we've seen be pretty useful for customers.
So many customers like GitLab CI, right?
Yeah, a ton of it. I mean, this today was great. Linkerd just came out of incubation. They're now a full-fledged project with CNCF. They were kind enough. They use GitLab for all their testing and everything. CNCF itself actually uses GitLab also. You can take a look at it at cncf.ci, and they use GitLab as a tool for the testing and all the CI platform as well.
Is GitLab anything else involved in other CNCF projects?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, almost. I mean, there's what, 35 plus projects now. And so we work, each individual maintainer and team gets to make the decisions based off of the way that the structure of CNCF exists on what they want to use for tooling. So we work with a whole bunch of the others as well. But there's a pretty good diversity of tooling, as you can imagine, across any open source projects. So.
And is GitLab also involved in the CNCF already?
So we sit on the board of the CNCF. We were voted in by the Silver members to help and represent them. We also sit on the board of the Linux Foundation. So we support in that side. We don't have, GitLab itself is not a project in the CNCF. It doesn't actually fit inside of the notion of what CNCF is focused on. It's focused around Kubernetes and operations, not the development side. So we're deeply engaged, but not our project obviously doesn't naturally fit or anything in it.
And what's your role there on the board?
Oh, sure. Board of Linux Foundation is helping build out open source projects, try and ensure that they have sustainability and maintainability. And then obviously we support with the CNCF helping also representing there's the Silver members in both the Linux Foundation and CNCF are by far the largest number and the most diverse. And a large number of the Silver members also operate as consumers of the projects or suppliers. So they're not necessarily a project in, say, CNCF. So most of the Silver members don't have a project in the CNCF. They're not one of the 35 projects, but they use those projects to enable development or
to build their application on top of
it. To build their applications, right. And so uniquely, because we have a very large distribution, very large customer base, and because we've, I think a lot of it has to do, we've been a pretty good steward of our open source tooling and everything for the years. I think it's been a pretty good fit where we see a lot of what they need and we try and do our best to help represent them.
So the Silver members vote sometimes a year or every 4 years or something like that. And this time you get represent for a certain amount of time.
Yep, it's correct. Yeah. So every 2 years, there's an election for both the CNCF and the Linux Foundation, and the Silver members each get a vote. And so there's an election, goes through a process of nomination, and then pretty standard, and then you get to vote on it. And so it happens about every 2 years, and so rotating on both boards, they rotate through those.
And what are the, at the moment, interesting things the board voted on?
I'll speak a little more because I actually sit on the Linux Foundation board. Priyanka from GitLab sits on the CNCF board. So the Linux Foundation, I think the really interesting stuff is Community Bridge. So a bunch of tooling to enable enable projects to manage and maintain their growth. And so there's just a lot of overhead in open source, and that's from managing the maintainers, running conferences, doing all of the building and the testing. These are all pieces that people appreciate the project, but there's a lot of work behind to make it work. And so Community Bridge is the initiative from the Linux Foundation to make that more sustainable for both the Linux Foundation and for any open source project. So that's the goal. I think that's probably the biggest one on the plate that we're focused on.
Okay, let's get back to GitLab. You said already Kubernetes. So is GitLab running on Kubernetes?
You can. So the short answer is you can run GitLab either on bare metal, on VMs, or on Kubernetes. So you have optionality depending on where you want to run it. We see a lot of customers, most customers are self-managed GitLab, meaning they run GitLab themselves, and they run it across the board and everywhere. And a lot of them use our Helm charts as what we use to deploy onto Kubernetes. Ton of customers using that. We also see customers oftentimes that already have an established GitLab footprint that are using for GitLab CI. We have a runner that's a basic Go binary that works extremely well. It's a great use case for Kubernetes. So they may continue to keep the source code where they've already had it, but as they're making the move towards adopting Kubernetes, They may put their runners on Kubernetes. So a runner is, and a build pipeline is ideal for Kubernetes because you're doing a lot of scaling up and down. It's very dynamic. So we see kind of all the above, and we meet customers really just right where they are.
And how does this work? I mean, okay, there's a runner. How do I define that I need 1 to 500 runners?
Sure. Yeah. So there's a GitLab server, and then there's the GitLab runner. So the GitLab server will orchestrate the number of runners and where you put them once you've designated what scale. So you can functionally adjust that however you want in terms of you could give it 5 possible runners, you could put 100 runners, and then you scale it out from there. So real dynamic, and the runners again exist then on different nodes. And so that's why Kubernetes is great. If you end up getting blocked or you hit a volume, Kubernetes will scale out the nodes and throw the runners against it. So fit real nice, kind of hand in glove on that use case.
And if it is on AWS or Azure or so, I can say, just use some of them, not all, that I don't burn my money in the public cloud.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, you can, again, if you have a Kubernetes cluster, it can be, you can allow it to scale or not scale. So if you're running a big cluster and you want the, say in this case, the runners to use extra capacity, that's a pretty common use case. If you're running a large Kubernetes cluster, you use your build farm, scales based off of your need. But you could also make it a smaller cluster. It just takes you longer to execute the runner. So it's just a trade-off you're kind of working through, which is capacity versus scalability versus the time that runner and the code build takes to get back to the developer.
I think last year you also introduced a container registry with GitLab. So if I have Docker images or so, I can put them in there.
Yep. Yeah. And I think that's at least a year. No, it's probably two plus years. It's been around for quite a while because that's pretty natural. End of the CI pipeline is would you build a container, right? Is the end of it. And If you're on a public cloud, there's container registries you may want to use, but oftentimes, again, a lot of these builds end up being on-prem. And so incorporating that as a part of the entire pipeline is much easier than, doing separate. Obviously, Docker's built a great business. They've done an awesome job in open source. And so, Docker Hub was a pretty natural fit and continues to be a real easy option to move that velocity through for customers.
Yeah, I think this was one of the big points for the success of Docker all along.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean they're a key reason that they're part of. We use Docker across the board for the build. We use it for, Docker Hub, as you had highlighted. So that changed everything for the industry.
But also there I can use another CNCF project. I mean, Harbor, if I choose to put my images in Harbor, it's also okay, right?
Yeah, it's completely fine. And we do have people that use Harbor. And from that standpoint, it's conversations that we're always having on what should be, for lack of a better, be baked into with GitLab. Harbor's a great option. We've chatted with VMware a number of times, and we do have customers that use it. So completely doable. And all of GitLab is composable if you wanted to, but we've made a decision to deliver the entire tool chain as one complete set. And we do it just because if someone wants to start tinkering with it, they're more mature and they're more than happy to do exactly that. But for most customers, the most important part in getting that velocity and getting used to it is being able to get to, what we're hearing a lot around here is continuous delivery. We're talking a lot about progressive delivery. In order to get to that stage, if you play with your pipeline and mess with it 50,000 times before you're mature on it, you're never going to get to the point that you get the advantage that all of this is promised. And so We focus on make it easy. We even optimize it in not just that we deliver a tool chain, but even a process, an opinionated process in it called Auto DevOps, that's focused on helping a customer get started from you know, the first commit all the way through deploying directly into a Kubernetes cluster. It's, you know, we've made those opinionated choices to get someone started. They can always go in and mess with the YAML file. Like, it isn't that it's not adjustable. It's just that for everyone to get started on this journey, and we see this here with this year here at KubeCon and EMEA being, I think it was 5,000 this year and it's 12,000 this year. So we're over double the size. There's just huge intake of people trying to really get up to speed. And we found a real need for people to have an opinionated starting point as they're getting mature. And then they can kind of adjust from there.
Also, a big issue is now GitOps, so DevOps a little bit further.
Sure. Yeah, so certainly, I mean, the end of the day is if you want to version something, everyone is coming back to the notion you have to handle versioning. And it gets particularly important in Kubernetes because you are moving to microservices. So that the number of services you're having to handle just expands dramatically. And then the operations behind that naturally also expand. And so in both cases, uniquely version control happens to be a really important spot to that. And Git being the predominant version control system is pretty obvious. And so we obviously do have a number of customers that use GitLab for the GitOps operations as well.
Some time ago, GitHub was bought by Microsoft, and it's also affected you a little bit. Can you tell me how?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, the initial one is we obviously saw a number of projects move over, particularly very opinionated open source projects that want their code to live with open, being an open source tool. Continue to have a lot of uptick, and so a lot of work with a lot more open source projects. A lot of that you see here at CNCF. Naturally, it's also a question I think customers have asked us, and I think time will tell, is how closely GitHub and Azure are combined. And we've seen that pretty consistently across each time that Microsoft and or GitHub roll out something new. Traditionally starts that the best integration or maybe the only integration at launch is with Azure, or you have a really good integration with, you know, Active Directory and GitHub IDs. And so each step with this is good for you if you are an Azure customer, and that's obvious. I think we'd expect nothing different. The question just becomes what that means for the world that is running in a bunch of different places. And so naturally, that's an area that we focused on. We will continue to really support and work with Microsoft and have a lot of customers there and good overlap. But we also naturally work very closely with the other big cloud providers, with Google, with Amazon for sure, with, you know, DigitalOcean, with Red Hat, with IBM, with VMware, with Cisco. And so we continue to see, I think that's going to be an area that we're going to show a lot of strength.
So the acquisition was a big effect, I can hear, but there will still be an effect in the future if you say, okay, tighter integration might flip other people.
Yeah, I mean, the integration changed a few things. I would say it was the choice of our business model made a much bigger difference than the acquisition of GitHub. So the decision to be an open user-based open core model means that because we're the only open source Git option, that's why 2/3 of the private Git repositories are GitLab. And so as customers are able to adopt and use it anywhere, I think that was the biggest decision that led to the uptick in what we've seen. And at this point, we're just seeing people move from just Git to a lot more using CI. And as they move from just source code to CI to also using our planning upstream and the CD functionality downstream, the monitoring with Prometheus that's built in, each one of those are really the reasons for the adoption. I don't know, we saw some uptick from that acquisition, but I would say the majority of it was the business model and the rabid, really happy customers that can pick it up and use it as individual developers, and then they really bring it into their companies and their environments.
So you said you're using an open core model. When do I need to order a license? So when can I use the open source version, and when is the point reached? Okay, now I have to pay.
Great question, and really critical to understand. So we have what's called user-based open core. So we have many customers that are 4,000 users using our core offering, which is free. So there's no number that someone hits from a number of developers that they would ever have to pay. What we mean by user base is that when we think about where the paid offering tiers are in GitLab, we orient them based off of who the buyer is, as in who the features match to the buyer. And our primary buyers would be a manager. So as you get big enough team, you're going to want to have insight into the code that your team's developing. That's a natural piece as you get bigger. And so we charge some for that, those options. The next version up, which is what we spend a lot of time, is called premium. And that's focused on your VP of app dev. And that's going to give a lot more dashboarding. It's going to give you idea of your code velocity. And those are areas there. And then the final offering is focused on the CISO. And that's where we embed the security in the pipeline. And so the way it works is relatively simple. Anyone can use GitLab for free. And as you start hitting these points at which, say, your code is valuable enough that you want to be doing static code analysis, dynamic code analysis, linting in your pipeline, that's a time that you would look and say, hey, it's worthwhile. My code needs to have these needs to have this kind of testing. Hey, now it's a paid offering. And so that's worked extremely well for us because it allows people to adopt it in line with the value of the code they're delivering, right? So if you wanted to be doing all your security testing, you probably at this point, your code's bringing you dollars and value, which means it's a natural fit for you to move towards a paid offering. Does that help?
A little bit. And there, and there are two versions. I can use it on-prem and as a SaaS, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So about 85% of our customers are self-managed. Now, as a self-managed customer, you can use one of the two primaries as an omnibus deployment, which we'd use for VM or bare metal, or you can use a Helm chart to run it on Kubernetes. Both of those, and that's about 80% of our customers. We also run a SaaS, which is GitLab.com. We have chosen to run the same code base in our SaaS as we do and deliver to customers, and that's also... that's not how anyone else in the market does it. They have a separate, completely separate code base between the two. The reason we do that is we want to make sure that as we've scaled GitLab.com, we ensure that everything we learn there at scale, which is brought back into the code base for our customers that also need to run it at scale.
And are there any limits in the SaaS version?
Nope, we got about 10 million repos and we have some huge massive customers running it. So yeah, it's been a real good growth engine for us as well. But we continue to see the majority of customers continue to want to have and own their own tool set. And so we offer the flexibility to be either and happy to support customers either way. We don't charge a different price, same price either way. And happy to help customers just depending on whatever choice they need to make.
And if I'm an open source project, I can use the SaaS variant, the SaaS version for free, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. For education and for open source projects, we have a very open policy to support, and there's not a cost for that. Give a whole lot of build minutes as well. It's not unlimited build minutes, but it's a pretty large chunk of build minutes that we work with the project. So clearly very happy to continue to help any projects that need to. We've been blessed as an open source company by a lot of really good work everyone else has done. And we're really adamant about making sure that we give back as much as possible to the community while we're going.
And if I find a bug or have a feature request, how do I do that?
Excellent. Yeah, everything, our entire roadmap and everything is at GitLab.com. So you can see both the roadmap and then you can open an issue on any feature request you would want. And you're corresponding directly with our project managers and our engineers. So yeah, we'll take that direct feedback. We also do share again our roadmap out. We try and push it out. You'll see it about a year and a half out. Of where we intend to go, where we'd like to develop, and then you'll see what's releasing. We release every month, so you'll see the release cycle. Everything gets tagged to which release it's coming out on.
Okay, thank you very much. Brandon Young, responsible for partnerships and alliances with GitLab, and for telling us how GitLab works, what it is, and how the CNCF and Linux Foundation works a little bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
This is Max Spivak with the Fedora Project, and you're listening to Radio Tux.
I'm here on the KubeCon now. With me is Jos Berkus. He is a Kubernetes community manager for Red Hat. Hi.
Hi.
So what do you do as a community manager?
So Kubernetes is a really big community. We have somewhere like 2,000 contributors or whatever. I mean, like regular contributors. And so as a result, we need a whole management group just to manage the people who contribute to the project and make sure that they can keep contributing and that things are going well, et cetera. So a lot of the companies that are invested in Kubernetes, including Red Hat, assign staff to that. So Google has a couple of community managers, VMware has a couple of community managers assigned. I do it for Red Hat. There's folks, I don't know, working for other companies, who help manage the project. And that includes things like, mentorship, making sure people moving up the contributor ladder, managing things like, how our GitHub presence works, and then I also do a lot with the release team. I'm basically on the release team every other cycle, in order to keep the Kubernetes releases moving.
And are you doing this just for the people at Red Hat or for the whole community with Kubernetes?
It's primarily for the Kubernetes community. I mean, I also have duties at Red Hat that have to do with Red Hat's contributions to Kubernetes, and the Kubernetes-related technologies that we're interested in, things like Kubevert, et cetera, that are related to Kubernetes and that we also want to promote. But primarily it's about the Kubernetes project itself.
And what's your role there? Are there meetings from all community managers?
So the primary community management, there's several different ones, right? So, I'm primarily active. I'm active on SIG release. So releases, et cetera. And I'm active on, by the way, SIGs are, because it's such a large project, it's divided up into committees, that are called SIGs. And the SIGs own their own individual areas. People are more familiar with the ones that are related to functionality, right? Like SIG networking does what it sounds like, right? Everything related to networking. SIG storage deals with storage, et cetera. But there's also ones related to other parts of the project. So SIG release handles releases and release tooling and everything related to that. And SIG contributor experience, is about, the people who contribute to Kubernetes, and what it's like to contribute to Kubernetes and making sure that, doing tutorials and stuff. We run contributor summits as we did here on Monday. We run contributor summits for people to learn how to be a Kubernetes contributor and then for contributors to meet and discuss things. But there are other areas of that because there's also SIG project management and SIG architecture who are more about, the actual management and structure of the code for the project as a whole and the process of getting code into Kubernetes. So it's a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, the project's the size of a mid-sized company, so we have a mid-sized company worth of management.
And are there regional meetings or just on other CNCF events like here?
No, it's mostly online. I mean, stuff happens via Slack and Zoom video conferencing. And of course, GitHub and GitHub issues, et cetera. There are sort of meetings and discussions at the contributor summits at the three KubeCons per year. We used to have, when there was only one KubeCon a year, some of the SIGs used to have separate in-person meetings. But since we have now three KubeCons a year around the world, and the CNCF is willing to provide us with space for SIGs to have meetings, there hasn't been any reason to have separate events.
Are these online meetings regularly?
Yes. Yeah, they're all in the Kubernetes community calendar. So they're all listed. Most of them have a regular weekly meeting time. Some of them are biweekly, depending on the SIG and how frequently they need to meet. But that's all calendared and regular. A few of the bigger, busier SIGs, like Contributor Experience, actually have alternating meeting times because there's just no meeting time you can pick that works for the entire world, right? And so they'll have two different meeting times that are 9 hours apart so that they can be convenient for Europe and convenient for Asia.
And are these democratic things that you choose to discuss there?
It's an open source project, right? So a lot of stuff works by effectively what we call volunteerocracy, right? Which is the thing that actually happens is the thing that somebody is willing to step up and implement. Because, you know, it doesn't matter if you're going to have a committee vote and you're going to vote that, hey, we're going to do this, if nobody's actually willing to take the time or write the code or whatever else that's required to do it. There is, for decisions that affect the whole project, there is a required sort of polling of feedback process. So, like, for example, if we're going to change the way that pull requests are approved, which has happened a couple of times in Kubernetes history, then we put that out on the Kubernetes dev mailing list and have like a week-long period of polling people for feedback, on the proposed change, and then bring it up at the general Kubernetes community meeting, that happens on Thursdays. And then based on all that feedback, the request might get modified. Usually it does, actually. And then that gets deployed.
You gave a talk here about benchmarking cloud native storage. Yeah. So what's the best storage?
Right. Well, the best depends on your workload and your requirements, right? Mostly, actually, what I wanted to do was I wanted to make it not scary for people, right? Because I've been working with Seth and the Rook team, and, you know, on the sort of cloud native storage, that's self-hosted, right? So our idea is that the storage daemons actually run Kubernetes, and then those supply storage to Kubernetes. And the advantage of that is you can have the sort of dynamic storage configuration kind of setup that you would have with a cloud provider, with like AWS or Google or whoever, but you can have it on your own hardware if you want. Plus it has some other useful properties. You know, the people that I know, because like I come from a database background, the people that I know, first question they have is, okay, well, all this sounds great, but how does it perform? Right? Because it doesn't necessarily need to be as fast, but it needs to hit their targets. And there haven't been good numbers out there. And so that's part of what I've been doing, is to just put out some good numbers on the internet that say, hey, this is how this performs in general, so people know whether they can consider it or not.
And which file systems or which projects did you test?
So far I've done two runs of tests. One of them happened on, it was mainly in AWS, so I wanted to test how this worked on a cloud provider. The other one was on bare metal. So then the tests were to test either the bare VM or the bare metal, versus local storage, versus on AWS using cloud provider storage, versus, using Rook and Ceph. And that's what I've tested so far. And then I do a series of benchmarks like Sysbench and PostgreSQL benchmarks and CockroachDB benchmarks, because they have a nice suite of benchmarks.
And which is the best for, let's say, for a database like Postgres?
Well, again, like I say, best depends on workload, right? Because anytime, I mean, if like your necessity is raw throughput or low latency, right? Like if that's your overwhelming thing, is you have these really tight latency targets, et cetera, then you're really going to want to use local storage, and you're going to want to depend on database redundancy, like replication and failover, et cetera, in the database, in order to make sure that you have redundancy for your platform, right? So in those cases where that's your requirement. On the other hand, if your main requirement is around ease of management, right? You want it to be really easy for people to deploy and stand up databases and not worry about where the particular storage is located. Then something like Rook or Ceph could be really nice, right? You about double your latency, sacrifice about 50% of your throughput on some workloads. But if you were only using 10% of your potential throughput to begin with, you don't care, right? And you do care that the DBA doesn't even need to be involved in the deployment of non-critical databases, right? The storage is just there because Ceph is supplying it for you.
And if I use Ceph, I have two or three copies, and that's better if one node goes down.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is the redundancy is what it's part of what it's there for, is that if, you know, anytime you're talking about a scalable cloud infrastructure, right, the minute that you get into more than even if you have one server, you lose servers, right? And if you've got 100 servers, I guarantee you a server being offline is going to be an every other day occurrence. And so your infrastructure needs to take that into account, and that includes your storage infrastructure.
And yeah, when do I need to use SAS or ZAN or so? So if latency is an issue, then I should use that.
Well, nothing's going to beat local storage, like direct attached storage for latency. I mean, just nothing is. Because anything else is going through some form of network layer that's going to be substantially slower. Honestly, for me, network attached storage tends to be, well, primarily network attached storage is, that's cloud provider storage, right? Number one, right? All, you know, if you're on AWS or Azure or whatever, all storage is network attached storage. But leaving that aside, if you're looking at your own hardware and bare metal hardware, right? For me, network attached storage is only for specific use cases and kind of what you come to if you can't make anything else work. Because I have a lot of, before I started working at Kubernetes, I was a professional database geek. I used to work on Postgres. And I absolutely could not count the number of hours that I accumulated troubleshooting problems with network attached storage. It's very high overhead in terms of your staff compared to any other form of storage.
And if I use a cloud native info storage solution like Rook, then I have to use these CSI, this container storage interface stuff.
Well, right now Rook uses an older plugin mechanism to Kubernetes called Flex Volume. Flex Volume was a predecessor to CSI. There is a beta CSI driver, so eventually you are going to be using CSI because everything in Kubernetes is going to be using CSI. Right. This is part of one of the major technical goals of the Kubernetes project is we're pushing everything that can be pushed out to a published API is being pushed out to a published API, right? Storage, networking, cloud provider, container runtime, policy management, really everything, because the thing is Kubernetes is sort of the operating system for server clusters, right? And as the operating system for server clusters, there are a million different things people want to do with it. And there's no way that within the core project, we can support those million things. And so we need to have a much more minimal conception of what the Kubernetes code is and focus a lot more on the APIs, which is what we've been doing. And so then people can build their own stuff and use those APIs.
And it's interchangeable. Then I have a project which for a network, and if it doesn't feed my needs anymore, I can change it.
Yes. Yeah. And so like that's one of the other things that people requested that I do in my next round of performance testing, for example, is to test different network plugins. Because obviously for containerized storage, the performance of the network plugin could be really important. And therefore, you know, want to actually check that. And you then provide feedback to the people who actually work on those. Because if one of them has really terrible performance, then it's like, hey, you guys should probably know about this. But so that's always been swappable, and the CSI is making the storage layer swappable, right? Because again, you know, heck, Rook is not even the only distributed storage thing out there, right? People might want to use something else. And we want to enable that.
I saw a talk about Rancher's Longhorn or something like that. It's also a little bit like Ceph. They're using also for Kubernetes and doing twice copies and so on.
Okay. I haven't looked at it at all, so don't really know anything about it.
How was the feedback for your presentation?
Pretty good. We had a bunch of people who were interested in things. Mostly, you know, people were interested in the numbers, et cetera. Cause for a lot of people, it's the first time they've seen any, solid numbers. I need to follow up with, finishing publishing my test specifications, because part of what I was trying to get across to people is here's what I did, but you really need to test your own hardware and your own infrastructure. And for that matter, do your best to run tests that simulate your own workloads. Because like, for example, you know, I say, hey, Ceph actually has great performance on parallel sequential writes. It actually is better than single node performance on parallel sequential writes. But if you're not doing parallel sequential writes, that doesn't matter, right? So you actually need to know what workload it is you're running and set up and run your own tests. And so people, I think, were receptive to that and they wanted more information on it. And then, of course, a bunch of the people who work on some of the storage projects want to do more testing. They want me to do more testing.
And how do I do the testing on my own? So which tools do I need? Yeah,
so the three tools that I actually talked about during the talk, because they are all easy to learn and relatively easy to use tools, there's a whole large suite of performance tools out there. But Sysbench, which is an IO testing tool developed by the MySQL folks originally, that just gives you numbers on random writes, random reads, sequential, et cetera. I did a bunch of PGBench, which is a simple Postgres benchmarking tool that tests doing a lot of random database writes, in parallel. And two of the benchmark workloads from CockroachDB. So their bank workload, which is a lot like PGBench, and their TPCC-like workload. And that tool from them is called Workload, and it's actually really nice. You have to be prepared to set up CockroachDB, though, in order to make use of it. For which you could use Rook, for example, but the, and I think those are, cause there's more sophisticated tools like FIO, for example, that really does rigorously test your sort of file system stuff. But learning how to do useful tests in FIO is a substantial chunk of somebody's time. It's a very sophisticated tool, but it's hard to learn for that reason.
And classic Linux command line tools like DD or something like that?
It doesn't tell you that much, though, right? Because, right, you're going to do a DD to something, right? Then you're doing a single sequential write. But that tells you a little bit of something. But, for example, doesn't tell you what happens when you write in parallel. It doesn't happen. It doesn't tell you what would happen if you were writing multiple files. It doesn't tell you a whole bunch of other things. And it's a little, and then if you try to actually use it to make your own sort of pseudo benchmark thing, then it's hard to do that in a reproducible way. And why bother when other people have already written code for you?
How big was your test installation for that?
So this was a, the bare metal one that I did for here is 6 blades. Each one of them a 22 processor, 20 core, machine with 2 SSDs. And 128 gigabytes of RAM. Wasn't a completely ideal configuration simply because the amount of storage I have is only about double the amount of RAM that I had. So I couldn't really do tests where the workload was much larger than RAM, which is one of the things you actually want to do for storage if you want, because testing how the storage behaves when Linux is swapping, for example, is one of those things you really actually want to do if you think you can experience that. Yeah, and I couldn't do that with this particular setup.
Where do you announce your publication?
So when I've got everything together and it's a little bit less of a mess, which will be before KubeCon Shanghai, that will go, I'll post it on my Twitter feed, which is Fuzzy Chef. I'll post it on my blog, which is Database Soup. And of course, there'll be a repo up in GitHub.
And maybe if there's a repo, other people could say, okay, this is my test suite and I didn't this and that.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Josh Berkus, Kubernetes community manager for Red Hat, for telling us, yes, what is a community manager at Red Hat and how does the storage thingy with Kubernetes works. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Ja, und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende dieser Sendung. Wie gesagt, sehr, sehr viel Englisch diesmal, viele interessante Interviews hoffentlich, aus eurer Sicht natürlich auch. Ihr habt gehört als Musik diesmal Professor Click mit Pangea, Explosive Ear Candy mit Do You Still Dream und Luke Hash mit Walkman. Wie immer Musik, die rausgesucht wurde, einfach auf jamendo.com. Professor Click, schon eine ganze, ganze lange Zeit her, dass wir den mal wieder im Programm haben. Der hat auch irgendwas Neues gemacht, aber es lässt sich jetzt nicht mehr so einfach bei Jamendo runterladen. Deswegen habe ich etwas Altes von ihm rausgesucht. Aber der hat jetzt im Juni auch wieder mal was Neues veröffentlicht. Also da könnt ihr auch gerne auf Soundcloud oder sowas mal reinhören. Genau, dann, ja. Wie gesagt, sind wir schon am Ende. Ich hoffe, wir hören uns dann im August wieder. Ich bin im August auf der FrostCon, Mitte August, 11. 12. August, sowas. In dem Dreh ist die FrostCon in der Nähe von Köln oder in der Nähe von Bonn, in St. Augustin. Und ich habe auch einen Vortrag da. Da wird es um Smart Home gehen und was ich hier so die letzte Zeit schon getrieben habe, auch wenn jetzt in den letzten Monaten nicht so viel Zeit übrig war, wie ich das gerne gehabt hätte. Deswegen auch wieder diese etwas kurz und schnell zusammengeschusterte Sendung. Mir fehlt gerade einfach die Zeit für die vielen Sachen, die ich gerne machen würde. Aber da gibt es einen Vortrag und es gibt auch einen Sailfish-Treffen. Sailfish OS, das hatten wir ja auch schon öfter hier in der Sendung, für Interessierte, die nicht halt Android oder iOS auf ihrem Smartphone haben wollen. Die treffen sich auch an dem Samstag und da werde ich auch mal vorbeischauen, wobei das dummerweise natürlich genau in der Zeit liegt, in der ich auch meinen Vortrag halten muss. Aber gucken wir mal. Leszek ist vielleicht auch da, er weiß es noch nicht ganz genau, aber da er auch ein großer Selfish-Fan ist, hoffe ich, dass er zumindest am Samstag da ist und vielleicht schaffen wir es dann auch dort vor Ort noch ein paar Interviews zu führen oder eine Sendung zu machen. Ja, das war's eigentlich von mir. Ich wünsche euch wie immer eine frohe Zeit. Passt auf euch auf, habt Spaß und ja, dann bis zum August. Ciao.
Das war eine Sendung von Radio Tux, herausgegeben im Jahr 2019. Unter Creative Commons Lizenz, Namensnennung und Weitergabe unter gleichen Bedingungen. Lieder sind eventuell anders lizenziert. Mehr Infos auf radiotux.de. Unterstützt durch Manitou.